I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Ken, it's always a pleasure to be here.
Last week, you explored the need for having clear investment objectives and buying criteria, and I promised our listeners that you would explain exactly how these could be combined to help them shortlist suitable properties.
Okay, Ken, happy to do that. But perhaps first, if I quickly recap to remind our listeners of the different objectives and criteria. And I have this graphic here I call the rating matrix, which I'll explain in more detail in just a moment. But what I'll do, Ken, is I'll let you have a copy of this so that you can put it onto the website under the podcast as a resource which our listeners can then download. Because I think it'll make everything a lot clearer if they can better visualise exactly what I'm talking about. So as you can see, with that in hand, your eight investment objectives were enduring value, ongoing cash flow, steady growth, super growth, lending appeal, future collateral, cost control, and depreciation benefits. Now, the purpose of the buying criteria is to give you a method of rating each property as to how well those objectives are being met. So the criteria are the tenant calibre, the lease term, the recent construction, the flexibility of design, the lease structure itself, the absence of competition, good position, emerging trends, the passing yield, the council zoning, the title options, and the vendor motivation. Now, the way I like to look at it, and I help my clients on this same way, is to draw up what we call a matrix. In other words, across the top of the square, you have your eight investment objectives, and then down the left-hand side, you have your buying criteria. Now, if you do it that way, what's interesting is that you can, and the reason you'll understand now as to why I've ranked the buying criteria in the order that I have, is that the first five, and that is the tenant caliber, lease term, recent construction, the flexibility of design, and the lease structure, all meet or help meet seven of the eight investment objectives. Not all the same ones, but they measure seven out of eight. And that's why they're in the top five of your buying criteria. So, in other words, tenant caliber will meet all of your investment objectives except depreciation benefits, as will the lease term. Whereas recent construction will meet all of them, including depreciation benefits, but not super growth. And flexible design, the one that doesn't meet, will be lending appeal. So you can see how these work together in the matrix, and the lease structure, again, doesn't meet your depreciation benefits. So you look at your next three buying criteria, and that's your absence of competition, good position, and emerging trends, and they'll meet six out of eight. It's the last two they don't meet, the cost control and depreciation benefits, but they do meet the other six. And then when you get to passing yield, you find that doesn't really help meet steady growth or your cost control or depreciation benefits. And then you get to council zoning, and that meets four out of the eight. And title options will only meet three, as does the vendor motivation. And that's why they're ranked the way they are. Now, what I've done for my clients, and I use myself, is what I call the high-speed filter, and that is by creating a little piece of software, you can very quickly rate each of the items there, the tenant caliber right through to the vendor motivation, as to how well a property, by what the way it's constructed and all the various components, as to how well each of those buying criteria help meet the investment objectives. Now, this has the advantage when you do that. And as I said, because the various buying criteria have a different importance. They are given a different weighting. So even though there are 12 buying criteria, and even if you rated each one of those 10 out of 10, the overall total would only reach 100 because of the different weighting that they have. The ones at the top of the list have a higher weighting and the ones at the bottom have a lesser weighting. So what I try and teach clients is that this method is a little bit like when you interview people for a position in your firm. You tend to remember the more attractive applicants or details about the last one or two that you interview. And so your ultimate judgment is often subjective rather than objective. And so by doing it this way and physically rating each property out of 10 as to how each of the criteria are met, you end up with an objective assessment of each property very quickly. And my rule of thumb is that unless the property ends up with a rating of 70% or better, you're not going to proceed. In other words, the idea of the high-speed filter is to allow you to very quickly assess each of the properties just sitting outside with your laptop or your iPad and to quickly come up with a rating that decides whether they get onto the shortlist or they don't get onto the shortlist. Now, what I'm in the process of doing right now is to create an app, which is not as easy as it sounds, so that you can then very quickly, whether you're in your office or your car or just standing outside the property, can quickly rate the property and make an assessment as to whether it ought to make your shortlist or not. And Ken, as soon as I've got the app finalised, which will probably take me a couple of months, I'll make sure that we put it up on the website and give people a link so that they'll be able to download it straight to their iPhones or iPads and then use it when they're reviewing their properties.
Now you have a short list of potential properties. What would be the best way to compare them financially?
Yeah, Ken, when it gets down to financial analysis, it's obviously a far more complicated process than just the 1 to 10 rating. And that's because you actually need a sophisticated piece of software, and there are a number in the marketplace. Well, I've developed one that I make available to clients. But you need to process about 18 separate elements. And just to quickly run through them, you've obviously got your purchase price, your stamp duty, acquisition costs, and things like your due diligence that you have to do, the cost of that. You need to include your loan value ratio, any setup costs associated with the mortgages, the interest rate. Then you've got to include your tax rate, and that may vary whether it's an individual, a company, or a unit trust or a super fund. You've got to take into account the passing rental, the rental reviews, the unrecouped outgoings, an ongoing management fee, depreciation. You've got to work out the holding period, your estimated selling yield down the track, and I'll come back to that in a moment, the selling costs at that time, and then for capital gains tax, you've got to include things like your initial cost base. Now, without going into the intricacies of the software, what's important is you need to have a fixed time that you make your comparisons. Now, generally, I look at it over a four-year period. Now, there a lot of software packages stretch it out over 8 to 10 years. Now, there are two problems with that. One, it's very hard to make estimates out that far. But also, what that does is it spreads your purchase or acquisition costs, stamp duty and legals and things like that, and your selling costs, your commission and advertising, over a much longer period. I generally pick 4 years because if the property doesn't make sense over 4 years, then you're kidding yourself to look at it over 8 to 10 years to make an economic return. I generally say that on an after-tax basis, as a rule of thumb, over that four-year period, if you are getting a return of 10% per annum on your equity after tax, that property ought to be worth considering. Now, you've got to understand that some people might say, Well, I'm buying it for the long-term hold, and that's okay. The reason I did it over 4 years, and I don't know what the magic of 4 years is, but generally over that period, or at the end of that period, people have a change of circumstances. They get married, they get divorced, they have kids, whatever it is, they get transferred overseas, and there's a change of circumstances. And therefore, whether you plan to or not, I believe it's a good idea to have a mandatory four-year review, and that's why I picked that period. Now, you may choose to continue to hold the property, and that's fine, but you've got to know going into the deal that if, for whatever reason, you find yourself having to sell the property in 4 years' time, that it's going to make economic sense. It's been a good deal going forward. And so that's where this software produces what's in technical terms is called the internal rate of return. In other words, what annual return does the projected future after-tax cash flow represent per annum as a percentage of the equity that you're putting into the property? And after-tax is important because that takes account of your relative tax position, and obviously if you've got negative gearing and things like that, that's taken into account as well. So that you know that if you're getting a 10% or better return after tax, it means before tax you're probably getting, depending on your tax rate, anywhere from 14% to 18% pre-tax rate. And that's not too shabby. So an after-tax 10% return is the base. It's like the 70% in the high-speed filter. Anything less than that, you don't continue to pursue. But the beauty with this is that by distilling your comparison down into a single figure, that internal rate of return of 10% or better after tax, it means that you can compare a property that might cost $500,000 with another property that costs $5 million. And so that you don't have that disparity of size and all the other factors influencing your decision. If the economics, cold hard economics, are there and they add up, well, then that's the way you proceed. And there's one other thing. Residential property tends to carry with it a degree of emotion. But with commercial property investing, and here I'm talking offices, warehouses, shops, probably in that order as preference, but in either of those commercial property sectors, it is an unemotional financial decision that you're making. Now, if it adds up financially, you may then have a preference by virtue of how the property looks and where it's located as to which one you prefer. But initially, you make your financial decisions to assess your shortlist as to whether they ought to remain on the shortlist. So once you've done that, you're then in a position to move forward from there.
And where would the investors uncover all that sort of information?
Well, whether it's for the high-speed filter or your later, more sophisticated software, you'll find most of the information is supplied by the selling agent, and they produce what's called an information memorandum, which gives an initial summary but then goes into detail on the lease, the rents, the reviews, all those sort of things, the outgoings, if there are any, that have to be picked up by you as the landlord, all the various terms and conditions that are related to the sale. So that information, if not, they'll generally provide that to you, or they will, some of the details, if you have to get town planning and things like that, if that's relevant. You can also obtain a copy of the vendor statement, which will have further details. So most of the information is pretty readily available, and it's a matter of just quietly and systematically going through. Now, once you've done the first few, you'll understand where to look and how to find the information, and if it's not readily available, what question to ask and to whom. But your first port of call ought be to the selling agent to obtain that sort of information.
So far, it sounds as though we've probably just been covering the prep work before getting down to this really serious stuff. Armed with all this information, are you now in a position to make an initial offer?
Well, not quite, Ken, because it's interesting that most people, when they venture from residential into commercial, they tend to want to make their offers subject to finance, and that's not going to fly in commercial. Sometimes in residential you can get away with it, but certainly not in commercial. Not if the property's any good, because the vendors know that if you're not interested, within a fortnight, or at the most a month, the property will be sold anyway. So why do they want to make it subject to finance? But you're actually asking the wrong question. It's not subject to finance. What you need to know is that the figure you pay does not exceed the figure that a valuer is prepared to support. And when you think of it that way, it makes a lot more sense. Because when you know what that figure is, that's what the banks are going to lend on. Now, a lot of people, and it happens in residential, that if you turn up to a bank with a contract for a residential property, particularly if you bought it at auction, generally they'll just accept that as the figure upon which they'll make their loans. Now, they may choose to have a short form valuation done, but it's really just to have something in the file. But with a commercial property, it's a lot different. And I've seen many cases where people have purchased a property and taken the contract to the bank, then the bank has arranged a valuation which actually comes in at less than the contract price. So it's important that you address that issue in advance. What it means is then that you're able to sleep at night knowing that the price you paid is going to match with the price upon which the bank will lend, so that you're not required, as a surprise, to have to put in more equity. I'm mindful that we do have certain time constraints today, so what I would probably prefer to do is to leave this topic over to expand it in far more detail when we meet next week, because it's so important that you don't lose sleep at night when you're going into a deal. And I've just seen so many clients who believe that they have negotiated a top price only to have the rug pulled from under their feet when the banks front up and tell them that the loan-to-value ratio is not quite what they expected. Now, we'll cover a little bit later how to actually control the whole funding process through with the banks so that you're the one in charge, not the banks calling the tunes. But this is the first step, and I'll explain, I think, next week in a lot more detail as to how we can actually take control of this whole process. And the other thing that is important is that in having the comfort of knowing how much you can pay, I'll also explain next week as to how you can often use that to your advantage as part of the negotiating process. So it's a matter of just getting all your ducks in a row and understanding the entire acquisition process. And I think you're starting to see that now, Ken, that it's not just negotiating the deal. There are 9 steps in this whole acquisition process, from identifying the property all the way through to its ultimate sale and every step in between. And unless you follow them sequentially and faithfully, that's when you get yourself into trouble. So as I said, if it's okay with you, let's run with that next week.
Looks like our time's up for today, which is a real pity, because I was finding all this rather fascinating. Anyway, thank you for joining me, Chris, and we'll talk again next week.
We certainly will.